Well.
Yeah, dinner is 5:15. But then there's a long line. Or what? Let's roll the tape, Beulah. And my name is Ingrid Christiansen, and the title of this session is The Joy Luck Club, is the name of the book by Amy Tan. And we're going to be reading a section out of it called Without Wood. So I want to tell you a couple of things about this book before I start. It's a book that is a novel, actually, and it's in four parts. The first part is about a group of women being raised in China and their experience, and it's called Feathers from a Thousand Li Away, and it's about four different women and each of their childhood experiences in China, and it gets them up to, well, it gets them through the sort of formative major experience of their childhood. And then the next section is called 26 Malignant Gates, and it's after they've moved to this country and live in San Francisco, and it's a terrible thing that happens to each one. And so it's the same four women, but an experience that's very formative in their 20s or 30s while they're in San Francisco. The third section is called American Translation, and it's about, well, the second section is about the mother and a daughter, and it's got something bad, although not devastatingly bad in every case, but something difficult that happened between the mother and daughter during the daughter's coming up years. And then the third section is about the daughter's adult life in this country, and I'm going to read you a piece out of that section. And the fourth section is the mother's as grandmothers reflecting on the daughter, in some cases going back to China. The fourth section is not as it's complex. A different thing happens to each of the four families. The four families are all friends with each other. And the Joy Luck Club, which is what this is named after, is basically the mother's women's group. It's these four women started the Joy Luck Club when they first moved to San Francisco as 20-year-old Chinese immigrants, because life was hard and they wanted to have some fun, and they thought it was better karma to be positive periodically. And so they would get together, they would play mahjong, they would have potluck, and they would talk, and they called it the Joy Luck because they wanted joy and they wanted luck. And they gave themselves joy and luck through the Joy Luck Club. And the Joy Luck Club continues all through their lives, and they continue. And in fact, eventually the families come, the husbands and children. And in fact, the overall structure of the book is that the woman whose turn it is to have Joy Luck Club at her house the next month or week dies. And she dies of an aneurysm in her brain, but her husband says it's because an idea was in her brain that was trying to get born. And the idea was that back in China, 60 years before, she had left identical twin girls sitting beside the road in the middle of an invasion because she was dying, she thought, herself, and she couldn't care for them, and she doesn't know what happened to them. And in the end, those girls are found. She spends her whole life writing letters to friends back in China trying to find these girls. And she does find them, but after she dies, the girls are found as adult women in China. An old girlfriend of this woman's, sees these two women coming down an escalator in a department store, identical twin women, and says, "You must be, you know, my friend's daughters." And they hardly recognize the name, but they had had a photograph of themselves with their names written on it, you know, tucked under their diapers when they were babies, that they remember the name then. And so then the family, the last section of the book, the family's reunited. And the sister, their American sister, who's sort of the consciousness through which that family is told, goes to China with her father and meets the sisters. And I cried, and they cried, and you know. But that's not what we're going to read today. Today we're going to read Rose Hsu Jordan, which is the third section. It's the daughter as a young adult going through a divorce, and she and her mother struggling with this divorce. It's called Without Wood. A couple of things about this section, some images that you might want to just look for and pay some attention to. There are lots of dyads or partners, opposite images or things that Amy Tan is looking at to see if they're opposites. And in the end, the story resolves itself by pulling wood and weeds together in an image. So wood and weeds, it's called Without Wood, the title, but wood and weeds is one thing you might look at in all the plant images, including plastic plants versus real gardens. Another thing is the wisdom of a mother versus the wisdom of a psychiatrist. A ballpoint pen versus a fountain pen. Plastic flowers, garden flowers, weeds and wood. American wisdom, American knowledge, and Chinese wisdom and knowledge. And then there's a little bit more, crying and laughing, a little bit more about the plants. Succulents are versus sort of perennials and annuals. And the succulent that's mentioned is aloe vera. And aloe vera, as many of you know, is a succulent that when you cut it and squeeze the, it's not even juice, it's like jelly out of it, and put it on a wound, it heals. It's a healing succulent. Okay. I used to believe everything my mother said, even when I didn't know what she meant. Once, when I was little, she told me she knew it would rain because lost ghosts were circling near our windows, calling woo woo to be let in. She said doors would unlock themselves in the middle of the night unless we checked twice. She said a mirror could only see my face, but she could see inside me even when I was not in the room. And all these things seemed true to me. The power of her words was that strong. She said that if I listened to her, later I would know what she knew, where true words came from, always from up high, above everything else. And if I didn't listen to her, she said my ear would bend too easily to other people, all saying words that had no lasting meaning because they came from the bottom of their hearts, where their own desires lived, a place where I could not belong. The words my mother smoked did come from up high. As I recall, I was always looking up at her face as I lay on my pillow. In those days, my sisters and I all slept in the same double bed. Janice, my oldest sister, had an allergy that made one nostril sing like a bird at night, so we called her Whistling Nose. Ruth was Ugly Foot because she could spread her toes out in the shape of a witch's claw. I was Scaredy Eyes because I would squeeze shut my eyes so I wouldn't have to see the dark, which Janice and Ruth said was a dumb thing to do. During those early years, I was the last to fall asleep. I clung to the bed, refusing to leave this world for dreams. "Your sisters have already gone to see old Mr. Chow," my mother would whisper in Chinese. According to my mother, old Mr. Chow was the guardian of a door that opened into dreams. "Are you ready to go see old Mr. Chow, too?" And every night I would shake my head. "Old Mr. Chow takes me to bad places," I cried. Old Mr. Chow took my sisters to sleep. They never remembered anything from the night before. But old Mr. Chow would swing the door wide open for me, and as I tried to walk in, he would slam it fast, hoping to squash me like a fly. That's why I would always dart back into wakefulness. But eventually, old Mr. Chow would get tired and leave the door unwatched. The bed would grow heavy at the top and slowly tilt. As I would slide, head first, in through old Mr. Chow's door and land in a house without doors or windows. I remember one time I dreamt of falling through a hole in old Mr. Chow's floor. I found myself in a nighttime garden, and old Mr. Chow was shouting, "Who's in my backyard?" I ran away. Soon I found myself stomping on plants with veins of blood, running through fields of snapdragons that changed colors like stoplights, until I came to a giant playground filled with row after row of square sandboxes. In each sandbox was a new doll. And my mother, who was not there but could see me inside out, told old Mr. Chow she knew which doll I would pick. So I decided to pick one that was entirely different. "Stop her! Stop her!" cried my mother. As I tried to run away, old Mr. Chow chased me, shouting, "See what happens when you don't listen to your mother?" And I became paralyzed, too scared to move in any direction. The next morning, I told my mother what happened, and she laughed and said, "Don't pay any attention to old Mr. Chow. He is only a dream. You have only to listen to me." And I cried, "But old Mr. Chow listens to you, too." More than 30 years later, my mother was still trying to make me listen. A month after I told her that Ted and I were getting a divorce, I met her at church at the funeral of China Mary, a wonderful 92-year-old woman who had played godmother to every child who passed through the doors of the First Chinese Baptist Church. "You are getting too thin," my mother said in her pained voice when I sat down next to her. "You must eat more." "I'm fine," I said, and I smiled for proof. "And besides, wasn't it you who said my clothes were always too tight?" "Eat more," she insisted. And then she nudged me with a little spiral-bound book hand-titled Cooking the Chinese Way by China Mary Chan. They were selling them at the door, only $5 each, to raise money for the Refugee Scholarship Fund. The organ music stopped, and the minister cleared his throat. He was not the regular pastor. I recognized him as Wing, a boy who used to steal baseball cards with my brother Luke. Only later, Wing went to divinity school, thanks to China Mary, and Luke went to the county jail for selling stolen car stereos. "I can still hear her voice," Wing said to the mourners. "She said God made me with all the right ingredients, so it'd be a shame if I burned in hell." "Already cremated," my mother whispered matter-of-factly, nodding toward the altar, where a framed color photo of China Mary stood. I held my finger to my lips the way librarians do, but she didn't get it. "That one, we bought it." She was pointing to a large spray of yellow chrysanthemums and red roses. $34. All artificial, so it will last forever. "You can pay me later. Janice and Matthew also chip in some. You have money?" "Yes. Ted sent me a check." Then the minister asked everyone to bow in prayer. My mother was quiet at last, dabbing her nose with Kleenex while the minister talked. "I can just see her now, wowing the angels with her Chinese cooking and gung-ho attitude," he said. When heads lifted, everyone rose to sing hymn number 335, China Mary's favorite. "You can be an angel every day on earth." But my mother was not singing. She was staring at me. "Why does he send you check?" I kept looking at the hymnal, singing, "Sending rays of sunshine, full of joy from birth." And so she grimly answered her own question. "He is doing monkey business with somebody else." Monkey business? Ted? I wanted to laugh. Her choice of words, but also the idea. Cool, silent, hairless Ted, whose breathing pattern didn't alter one bit in the height of passion. I could just see him grunting, ooh, 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 while scratching his armpits, and then bouncing and shrieking across the mattress, trying to grab a breast. "No, I don't think so," I said. "Why not?" "I don't think we should talk about Ted now, not here." "Why can you talk about this with a psychiatric and not with mother?" "Psychiatrist. Psychiatrics," she corrected herself. "A mother is best. A mother knows what is inside you," she said above the singing voices. "A psychiatrics will only make you hooly hoodoo, make you see high mung mung." Back home, I thought about what she had said, and it was true. Lately, I had been feeling hooly hoodoo, and everything around me seemed to be high mung mung. These were words I had never thought about in English terms. I suppose the closest in meaning would be confused and dark fog. But really, the words meant much more than that. Maybe they can't be easily translated because they refer to a sensation that only Chinese people have, as if you were falling headfirst through old Mr. Chow's door, then trying to find your way back. But you're so scared you can't open your eyes, so you get on your hands and knees and grope in the dark, listening for voices to tell you which way to go. I had been talking to too many people, my friends, everybody, it seems, except Ted. To each person, I told a different story. Yet each version was true. I was certain of it, at least at the moment I told it. To my friend Waverly, I said I never knew how much I loved Ted until I saw how much he could hurt me. I felt such pain, literally a physical pain, as if someone had torn off both my arms without anesthesia, without sewing me back up. Have you ever had them torn off with anesthesia? God, I've never seen you so hysterical, said Waverly. You want my opinion, you're better off without him. It hurts only because it's taken you 15 years to see what an emotional wimp he is. Listen, I know what it feels like. To my friend Lena, I said I was better off without Ted. After the initial shock, I realized I didn't miss him at all. I just missed the way I felt when I was with him. Which was what? Lena gasped. You were depressed. You were manipulated into thinking you were next to nothing. And now you think you're nothing without him. If I were you, I'd get the name of a good lawyer and go for everything you can. Get even. So I told my psychiatrist I was obsessed with revenge. I dreamt of calling Ted up and inviting him to dinner, to one of those trendy who's who places like Cafe Majestic or Rosalie's. And after he started the first course and was nice and relaxed, I would say, "It's not that easy, Ted," and from my purse I would take out a voodoo doll, which Lena had already lent me from her props department. I would aim my escargot fork at a strategic spot on the voodoo doll, and I would say out loud in front of the fashionable restaurant patrons, "Ted, you're just such an impotent bastard. I'm going to make sure you stay that way." Wham! Saying this, I felt as if I had raced to the top of a big turning point in my life, a new me after just 2 weeks of psychotherapy. But my psychiatrist just looked bored, his hands still propped under his chin. "It seems you've been experiencing some very powerful feelings," he said, sleepy-eyed. "I think we should think about them more next week." And so I didn't know what to think anymore. For the next few weeks, I inventoried my life, going from room to room, trying to remember the history of everything in the house, things I had collected before I met Ted, the hand-blown glasses, the macrame wall hangings, and the rocker I had recaned, things we bought together right after we were married, most of the big furniture, things people gave us, the glass-domed clock that no longer worked, 3 sake sets, 4 teapots, things he picked out, the signed lithographs, none of them beyond number 25 in a series of 250, the Steubenglass crystal strawberries, and the things I picked out because I couldn't bear to see them left behind, the mismatched candlestick holders from garage sales, an antique quilt with a hole in it, odd-shaped vials that had once contained ointments, spices, and perfumes. I had started to inventory the bookshelves when I got a letter from Ted, a note, actually, written hurriedly in ballpoint on his prescription notepad. "Sign 4 times where indicated," it read. And then in fountain pen blue ink, "Enclose check to tide you over until settlement." The note was clipped to our divorce papers along with a check for $10,000 signed in the same fountain pen blue ink on the note. And instead of being grateful, I was hurt. Why had he sent the check with the papers? Why the 2 different pens? Was the check an afterthought? How long had he sat in his office determining how much money was enough? And why had he chosen to sign it with that pen? I still remember the look on his face last year when he carefully undid the gold foil wrap, the surprise in his eyes as he slowly examined every angle of the pen by the light of the Christmas tree. He kissed my forehead. "I'll use it only to sign important things," he had promised me. Remembering that, holding the check, all I could do was sit on the edge of the couch, feeling my head getting heavy at the top. I stared at the X's on the divorce papers, the wording on the prescription notepad, the 2 colors of ink, the date of the check, the careful way in which he wrote, "$10,000 only and no cents." I sat there quietly trying to listen to my heart, to make the right decision. But then I realized I didn't know what the choices were. And so I put the papers and the check away in a drawer where I kept store coupons, which I never threw away and which I never used either. My mother once told me why I was so confused all the time. She said I was without wood, born without wood, so that I listened to too many people. She knew this because once she had almost become this way. A girl is like a young tree, she said. You must stand tall and listen to your mother standing next to you. That is the only way to grow strong and straight. But if you bend to listen to other people, you will grow crooked and weak. You will fall to the ground with the first strong wind, and then you will be like a weed, growing wild in any direction, running along the ground until someone pulls you out and throws you away. But by the time she told me this, it was already too late. I had begun to bend. I had started going to school, where a teacher named Mrs. Barry lined us up and marched us in and out of rooms, up and down hallways, while she called out, "Boys and girls, follow me." And if you didn't listen to her, she would make you bend over and whack you with a yardstick 10 times. I still listened to my mother, but I also learned how to let her words blow through me. And sometimes I filled my mind with other people's thoughts, all in English, so that when she looked at me inside out, she would be confused by what she saw. Over the years, I learned to choose from the best opinions. Chinese people had Chinese opinions, American people had American opinions, and in almost every case, the American version was much better. It was only later that I discovered there was a serious flaw with the American version. There were too many choices, so that it was easy to get confused and pick the wrong thing. That's how I felt about my situation with Ted. There was so much to think about, so much to decide. Each decision meant a turn in another direction. The check, for example. I wonder if Ted was really trying to trick me, or to get me to admit that I was giving up, that I wouldn't fight the divorce. And if I cashed it, he might later say the amount was the whole settlement. Then I got a little sentimental and imagined, only for a moment, that he had sent me $10,000 because he truly loved me. He was telling me in his own way how much I meant to him. Until I realized that $10,000 was nothing to him, that I was nothing to him. I thought about putting an end to this torture and signing the divorce papers. And I was just about to take the papers out of the coupon drawer when I remembered the house. I thought to myself, I love this house. The big oak door that opens into a foyer filled with stained glass windows, the sunlight in the breakfast room, the south view of the city from the front parlor, the herb and flower garden Ted had planted. He used to work in the garden every weekend, kneeling on a green rubber pad, obsessively inspecting every leaf as if he were manicuring fingernails. He assigned plants to certain planter boxes. Tulips could not be mixed with perennials. A cutting of aloe vera that Lena gave me did not belong anywhere because we had no other succulents. I looked out of the window and saw the calla lilies had fallen and turned brown. The daisies had been crushed down by their own weight, the lettuce gone to seed. Runner weeds were growing between the flagstone walkways that wound between the planter boxes. The whole thing had grown wild from months of neglect. And seeing the garden in this forgotten condition reminded me of something I once read in a fortune cookie. When a husband stops paying attention to the garden, he is thinking of pulling up roots. When was the last time Ted pruned the rosemary back? When was the last time he squirted snail be gone around the flower beds? I quickly walked down to the garden shed looking for pesticides and weed killer, as if the amount left in the bottle, the expiration date, anything would give me some idea of what was happening in my life. And then I put the bottle down. I had the sense that someone was watching me and laughing. I went back in the house, this time to call a lawyer. But as I started to dial, I became confused. I put the receiver down. What could I say? What did I want from divorce, when I never knew what I had wanted from marriage? The next morning, I was still thinking about my marriage, 15 years of living in Ted's shadow. I lay in bed, my eyes squeezed shut, unable to make the simplest decisions. I stayed in bed for 3 days, getting up only to go to the bathroom or to heat up another can of chicken noodle soup. But mostly I slept. I took the sleeping pills Ted had left behind in the medicine cabinet, and for the first time I can recall, I had no dreams. All I could remember was falling smoothly into a dark space with no feeling of dimension or direction. I was the only person in this blackness, and every time I woke up, I took another pill and went back to this place. But on the fourth day, I had a nightmare. In the dark, I couldn't see old Mr. Chow, but he said he would find me, and when he did, he would squish me into the ground. He was sounding a bell, and the louder the bell rang, the closer he was to finding me. I held my breath to keep from screaming, but the bell got louder and louder until I burst awake. It was the phone. It must have rung for an hour, nonstop. I picked it up. "Now that you are up, I am bringing you leftover dishes," said my mother. She sounded as if she could see me now, but the room was dark, the curtains closed tight. "Ma, I can't," I said. "I can't see you now. I'm busy." "Too busy for mother?" "I have an appointment with my psychiatrist." She was quiet for a while. "Why do you not speak up for yourself?" she finally said in her pained voice. "Why can you not talk to your husband?" "Ma," I said, feeling drained, "please don't tell me to save my marriage anymore. It's hard enough as it is." "I am not telling you to save your marriage," she protested. "I only say you should speak up." When I hung up, the phone rang again. It was my psychiatrist's receptionist. I had missed my appointment that morning as well as 2 days ago. Did I want to reschedule? I said I would look at my schedule and call back. And 5 minutes later, the phone rang again. "Where have you been?" It was Ted. I began to shake. "Out," I said. "I've been trying to reach you for the last 3 days. I even called the phone company to check the line." And I knew he had done that, not out of any concern for me, but because when he wants something, he gets impatient and irrational about people who make him wait. "You know it's been 2 weeks," he said with obvious irritation. "2 weeks? You haven't cashed the check or returned the papers. I wanted to be nice about this, Rose. I can get someone to officially serve the papers, you know." "You can?" And then, without missing a beat, he proceeded to say what he really wanted, which was more despicable than all the terrible things I had imagined. He wanted the papers returned, signed. He wanted the house. He wanted the whole thing to be over as soon as possible, because he wanted to get married again to someone else. Before I could stop myself, I gasped. "You mean to say you were doing monkey business with someone else?" I was so humiliated, I almost started to cry. And then, for the first time in months, after being in limbo all that time, everything stopped. All the questions gone. There were no choices. I had an empty feeling, and I felt free. Wild. From high inside my head, I could hear someone laughing. "What's so funny?" said Ted angrily. "Sorry," I said. "It's just that..." And I was trying hard to stifle my giggles, but one of them escaped through my nose with a snort, which made me laugh more. And then Ted's silence made me laugh even harder. I was still gasping when I began again in a more even voice. "Listen, Ted, I'm sorry. I think the best thing is for you to come over after work." I don't know why I said that, but I felt right saying it. "There's nothing to talk about, Rose." "I know," I said in a voice so calm it surprised even me. "I just want to show you something. And don't worry, you'll get your papers, believe me." I had no plan. I didn't know what I would say to him later. I only knew that I wanted Ted to see me one more time before the divorce. What I ended up showing him was the garden. By the time he arrived, the late afternoon summer fog had already blown in. I had the divorce papers in the pocket of my windbreaker. Ted was shivering in his sports jacket as he surveyed the damage to the garden. "What a mess," I heard him mutter to himself, trying to shake his pant leg loose of a blackberry vine that had meandered onto the walkway. And I knew he was calculating how long it would take to get the place back into order. "I like it this way," I said, patting the tops of overgrown carrots, their orange heads pushing through the earth as if about to be born. And then I saw the weeds. Some had sprouted in and out of the cracks in the patio. Others had anchored on the side of the house. and even more had found refuge under loose shingles and were on their way to climbing up to the roof. No way to pull them out once they've buried themselves in the masonry. You'd end up pulling the whole building down. Ted was picking up plums from the ground and tossing them over the fence into the neighbor's yard. "Where are the papers?" he finally said. I handed them to him, and he stuffed them in the inside pocket of his jacket. He faced me, and I saw his eyes, the look I had once mistaken for kindness and protection. "You don't have to move out right away," he said. "I know you'll want at least a month to find a place." "I have already found a place," I said quickly, because right then I knew where I was going to live. His eyebrows raised in surprise, and he smiled for the briefest moment until I said, "Here." "What's that?" he said sharply, his eyebrows still up, but now there was no smile. I said, "I'm staying here," I announced again. "Who says?" He folded his arms across his chest, squinted his eyes, examined my face as if he knew it would crack at any moment. That expression of his used to terrify me into stammers. Now I felt nothing, no fear, no anger. "I say I'm staying, and my lawyer will too, once we serve you the papers," I said. Ted pulled out the divorce papers and stared at them. His exes were still there, the blanks were still blank. "What do you think you're doing? Exactly what?" he said. And the answer, the one that was important above everything else, ran through my body and fell from my lips. "You can't just pull me out of your life and throw me away." I saw what I... His eyes confused, then scared. He was Huli Hudu. The power of my words was that strong. Huli Hudu being confused. That night I dreamt I was wandering through the garden. The trees and bushes were covered with mist, and then I spotted old Mr. Chow and my mother far off in the distance, their busy movements swirling the fog around them. They were bending over one of the planter boxes. "There she is," cried my mother. Old Mr. Chow smiled at me and waved. I walked up to my mother and saw that she was hovering over something as if she were tending a baby. "See," she said, beaming, "I have just planted them this morning, some for you, some for me." And below the high mong mong, all along the ground, were weeds already spilling out over the edges, running wild in every direction. Those inscrutable Chinese, huh? I looked back through at the weeds after that ending to try to see where they'd first come out and what the weeds seemed to be doing throughout the story. It was in the part where my mother once told me I was so confused all the time. She said I was without wood, born without wood, which remembers the title of the story, Without Wood. Born without wood so that I listened to too many people. She knew this because once she had almost become this way. "A girl is like a young tree," she said. "You must stand tall and listen to your mother standing next to you. That is the only way to grow strong and straight, to listen to your mother. But if you bend to listen to other people, you will grow crooked and weak. You will fall to the ground with the first strong wind, and then you will be like a weed growing wild in any direction, running along the ground until someone pulls you out and throws you away." So that's the first place the weeds come in. The theme of listening to your mother had been there since the beginning, and that you had to listen to your mother because that was the only way you could grow strong. Her mother had been married to in a respectable marriage in China, had this woman, and then her husband died, and she was forced to become the fourth wife of a rich man, a rich businessman. And then the rich businessman took a fifth wife who was a young, 14-year-old girl or something. So the fourth wife was a bottom status person and was not a good position, but also the businessman was not a good man. And So her mother, which is the grandmother of the woman who's getting divorced now, took poison and killed herself 3 days before the new year, because on the new year, the people who die in China in their belief system come back 3 days later to settle the accounts. And also, in their belief system, on New Year's Day, you have to make right all the wrongs you've done during the year or in your life. So every New Year's Day, if you don't make right everything, you're in deep trouble. And so this mother took poison 3 days before, knowing that she would then, her spirit would come back on New Year's Day when this bad businessman that she was married to would have to right his wrongs. And when she was dying of the poison, she said to her daughter, who is the mother of the main character here, "I did this to pour my spirit into you, to make you strong." And also she knew then that the financial situation of her daughter would be good and that she would be treated with honor, because this businessman would be so afraid of the ghost making his life miserable if he didn't treat her daughter well. So her mother had given her life for the daughter, and it had worked. I mean, the daughter was then in good circumstances. She was strengthened. She felt the strength of her mother poured into her, and she felt all her life as though that had really given her the strength that it took to have a happy life and a successful life and have a good family. So now, when she says to her daughter, "The only way to be a strong person is to listen to your mother," she's really speaking from with some deep roots there, and it really means something to her. Also in her faith, the main character here and her mother had been through something terrible when the daughter was a child. The daughter was a 12-year-old child and was supposed to babysit for her 4-year-old brother when their whole family was at the seaside and the brother drowned. And the mother tried to get prayed that the child would come back from the sea and be alive. And when that didn't happen, then the mother went to her old Chinese ways and tried Chinese faith to get the child to come back out of the sea and be alive, and that didn't succeed either. But at that point, that mother gave up her faith and took her Bible and put it, a white Bible, and put it as a leveler under the kitchen table leg, which was uneven. And she was not a meticulous housekeeper, but that Bible stayed meticulously white and clean for 20 years until this story. So there was, and in the Bible, before she put it under the table leg of the family table, she wrote the death of her son into the Bible. But she said she had no faith from that point on. So that's some background on this mother. She's a very strong and intense and principled person. How do you think the mother was handling the daughter's divorce? Do you have a sense of that? Did you hear enough of that?
Well, she wanted her to confide in her. I mean, she wanted the daughter to at least talk about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So she's probably feeling a little left out. Mm-hmm. What was happening.
Do you remember what she said about the psychiatrist?
And she also wanted the daughter to be kind of true to herself. I mean, be her own person. She said something about speak. Speak up or be yourself, mm-hmm. not to save the marriage, mm-hmm. but to be yourself.
Mm-hmm. She did, and she, when the daughter, remember, was in that sound sleep and woke up and it was her mother, and she said, "Mother, don't try to talk me into going back to Ted." And the mother said, "I'm not.
I just want you to eat."
Yeah. Eat. Speak up. Speak for yourself, you know, stand up for yourself. So the daughter was laying some stuff on the mother that wasn't there, really. I mean, she was assuming her mother was in a position that her mother wasn't really in.
It is interesting that the words that the daughter uses with the husband are identical to the words that the mother uses with the daughter. I mean, talking about the wood.
You refuse to touch.
pulling this and throwing out the weeds.
Mm-hmm. You can't pull me out and throw me away.
Yeah, which is exactly what she says about the garden.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the daughter starts to use the mother's thinking and language. At what point?
But when she looks at the weeds and decides she likes them. So that she uses the mother's words, but she doesn't. She sort of transposes it in a way. If her mother had been telling her, you don't want to be like a weed because someone will throw you out. But then she looks at those weeds and sort of decides, I like these weeds. I'm staying here. And if you pull them out, it will make the house fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of translation of what her mother said. She changes.
What do you think the title, Without Wood, is? Why do you think that's the title?
She was probably for a little while without wood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the transition that she was going through. But then she discovered that maybe she wasn't without wood.
Or that she could be strong without wood.
Yeah,
or that she could be strong for herself, not from just her mother's strength.
Mm-hmm. Because when she talked about that her mother said she had to be upright and only listen to her mother and be with wood, she said it's too late. You know, since I was a child, that is the story about the teacher who had changed that, and that, you know, I've listened to many different voices. It's too late for me to have wood in me, to be with wood.
Without wood is not so bad.
Yeah, and she also saw beauty.
I mean, weeds are strong. You pull it out and the house goes crumbling.
Mm-hmm.
Weeds are maybe no good.
Freedom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's something to that. Because she'd already lost, she wasn't going to have wood. It wasn't her nature, and it was too late for that. What were you just going to say? The same thing. Yeah, I was a little puzzled by this ending at first. I couldn't figure out why. Below the Haimongmong, which is the dark fog, all along the ground were weeds, already spilling out over the edges, running wild in every direction. But weeds represented life and growth and strength and inventiveness and flexibility. Her mother was planting them. And her mother said, I have just planted them this morning, some for you and some for me. I mean, that mother, who had been rigid and damaged by being rigid, I mean, like deciding no more Christian faith because my son was drowned, you know, had made some decisions like that that were rigid in her life, and also was sacrificing some parts of her relationship with her daughter by being rigid and disapproving. And
the weeds go, they're kind of a nice parallel to the things that she bought. That she bought a quilt with a hole in it, and she bought all these that are sort of like weeds.
Mismatched candlesticks.
And with all of number 25 in a series of 200 and stupid glass. You know?
Yeah.
So that was being true to herself, to be like a weed, because that's what she bought, that's what she wants.
Mm-hmm.
The weeds run under the fog, I noticed in the last thing you just read. Mm-hmm. She had trouble with the fog, and she'd have trouble with the fog if she were growing tall, but she'd run under it.
And have clarity.
Yeah.
Yeah. And her husband at that point had the word for confused, the huli hoodoo. And he was confused because her style changed so at that point. She became a different person. She didn't react in the same way as he had traditionally expected her to react. And so she was in a much freer position vis-a-vis him. And presumably for the rest of her life. I mean, she had to sort that out, who she was going to be without him.
I thought it was interesting, though, that she didn't know how she was going to react when he came. You know, she had nothing kind of planned in her head. And oftentimes when you're going to have that kind of situation, you sort of figure out what you're going to say, you know. And anyway, that's the sense you get. And I think kind of surprised herself.
to what did come up when she heard herself say things. It reflected off, and then she went from there to the next step and the next step. And I thought that was really interesting to see that.
Yeah, and what she seemed to be doing there is going with her intuition.
Yeah.
Which is maybe...
Which is not wood.
Yeah, it's not wood.
That's not wood.
So what does being Chinese or being American sort itself out along these lines? Can we say...
Well, do we know if Ted was Chinese?
He's not. Blonde and blue-eyed. His parents had been angry at their marriage because she was Chinese. It was socially inappropriate for him to marry beneath himself. It seemed like the intuition and going with your gut was more of a Chinese way, but the Chinese going with your gut was so complicated. I mean, you had to know all these stories and myths, and you know, they all really influenced you. I mean, she was deeply... Mr. Chow, was a deep part of her psyche. And he wasn't necessarily either bad or good. I mean, he was scary, nightmare sometimes, and he was a force for safe sleep, and he was calling to her at the end, and she was positive about it. I mean, he was good in lots of ways. But the mother had, that was the mother's thinking, the Chinese thinking. But
in a funny way, the mother's wood goes with Ted's don't mix up the flowers. There's this sort of parallel rigidity there. And she has to find a way between both kinds of rigidity.
That's right.
So that in a way, his trying to throw her away frees her in both, from both kinds of rigidity.
I wonder whether this story reflects any real feelings for those of you who've been through divorces. Is the kind of experiences that she had, like from day to day, changing how she felt, and yet each day thinking it was the way she felt? You know, thinking she was terribly sad he was leaving her, and then thinking that she was lucky to be rid of him, and thinking that she was going to get vengeance on him, and then going into 4 days of sleep, drugged sleep, and not knowing what she wanted.
I didn't sleep for 4 days the way she did, but I slept on the couch for months and months and months. Somehow that back, that was a security thing. And I pictured throwing gallon cans of purple and red and black paint on his garage door. But she was much stronger at the end than I ever was. I really admire that. If, you know, women can be that way. Say, I'm not leaving this house. Oh, that was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. We don't know how long. I mean, strength, I think, is something that's given to us and periodic doses, but not something you can really depend on when you're...
You know whether she got the help or not.
We don't know if she won that battle.
Or it doesn't tell later. We won't find out if we read the book.
No, you won't, in fact. But I don't think it really is the key to it. I mean, what you have the sense is that she's going to be okay.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much true in all four of these families. The mothers and daughters. You have the sense that there's some very deep, profound level of reconciliation and growth that happens between the mother and daughter. Like here, this weed business, the fact that the mother planted some for herself and some for her daughter. And I mean, that was all... I think that's reconciliation.
It's like the daughter had influence on the mother the way the mother had wanted to have influence on the daughter, but that it was kind of a parallel... sharing the influence.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
A more compatible, more equal kind of relationship rather than all of it going one direction.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, like the mug jug that pouring out into the daughter which had been unsuccessful, wasn't working, frustrating for both of them, and a one-way mode of communication seems now to be changing, judging from what the images are at the end of the story.
Well, the grandmother had apparently been a victim, so then the mother would say, you have to stand up for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So each generation, that kind of suggests itself a little bit.
Yeah. In Chris Grimm's session this morning, she was talking about the American difficulty of dealing with death and how we have to think of death as part of life and how...
Yeah, I'll leave you with just a thought. This is not true just of Latin America, but around the world.
That woman,
and one priest has written a book, which they don't have in the library here.
She was making a very strong move by killing herself.
He's been working in Africa and Tanzania with the Maasai people.
Strengthen her daughter and give her daughter real life.
He's been doing the most interesting
thing. She felt like she was a prostitute.
Now, of course, being investigated
to go on that way and didn't see any alternatives, but she saw an alternative for her child.
He discovered by entering into popular religion, when often the healer person was a woman,
strong move at that point,
the way the whole community functioned because of their belief systems and their practices, it was more logical to have her do the sacrament, the Holy Communion. So that's what has gotten into trouble. But I found it just fascinating that he could be so free from his culture, his background in whatever country it was, and enter in with what you would call the gospel without cultural wrappings on it, but the pure gospel, if there is such a thing. Okay, thank you for coming.
Now, isn't that the end of the palm trees? The reason they exist in the tropics is because when the hurricanes come, they can bend. Instead of if they were like an oak, they would snap. Uproot.
She doesn't say trees, she says wood. Much deeper. Wood is lumber or timber or something much more rigid, or a tree might be a living
wood. And actually it doesn't tell about it in this section about her, but it does talk about her marriage more in an earlier section, and the marriage is not much good for her. The man makes all the decisions and she becomes stammering and powerless in his presence, really. And then he loses a lawsuit, you know, the doctors have, what are they called? Malpractice suit. And then he loses the ability to make decisions. And then he gets angry at her, and then they start to fight because she won't make decisions because she's been conditioned not to over all this time, and he feels that he can't because he's scared. And that's when their real difficulties come up. So that was the beginning of the end for them. Well, I guess that's the time. I really like the book, and obviously it loses something by only hearing part of it, but I do really recommend the whole thing. Partly because of these nice workings out of relationships between moms and daughters, partly because of the friendships of the four moms and the four daughters, who all are friends. And just for many reasons, I think it's a really wonderful book. And so it's only out in hardback so far, but it'll come out in paperback in the next few months. So then I think it's something you ought to consider getting. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.